you hang around with anyway?
Who do I hang around with? I mean, well, this afternoon, right here in the studio, we're going to hang around with Terry Fugate Wilcox.
Oh, I know that guy.
He is a famous artist in Hudson, New York.
You can't miss him.
And I'm going to ask him to put on his earphones so he can hear himself.
Put on earphones. And, oops. And then you got to talk right into the microphone.
You have your very own mic and everything.
Yeah.
We aim to make people comfortable here.
It's getting there.
Okay, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Do you hear me through your ear thingies?
I only wear these for helicopters.
You got to get on the microphone, though, if you want anybody to hear you.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go.
Well, Mr. Fugate Wilcox comes to us because he is having a show, a new show that just opened, or is it, when is it opening? Maybe I've jumped the gun here.
Last Saturday, but...
Oh, it was last...
Was the official opening, but every Saturday's a...
Every Saturday's an opening.
Yeah.
And at a new gallery in what is known to many Hudsonians as the LB Factory, who used to be a chair factory. And it's now populated by antique dealers and all kinds of art galleries and various things. Hmm. And someone has opened a new gallery, I believe. It's Chris Selleck?
Chris Selleck, yeah. She's a professor at FIT and decided to put aside the furniture and bring art to the warehouse. There's actually 9 artists there now and 3 galleries, 4 galleries. So we may be in the beginning of something happening.
It's a new neighborhood for galleries down there.
It's spectacular. I don't mean to plug it, but I'm going to plug it. It's really, I mean, you get a studio for very little money and no worries about the snow and neighbors and noise and make your art. It's pretty pretty exciting. I was looking for a barn with a bathroom for over 2 years, and the warehouse was staring me in the face for a studio and a place to show. And the energy is really positive, too. It's everybody is fiercely independent and trying to do something a little different and, what do you call it, repurpose the warehouse. Yeah. So I'm showing over 200 works of art that I started in 1977. And they became art, a large part of the work became art this year. Through things, changes, and how they evolved over the years existing, and now they're shown as works of art.
What were they before that?
Just a collection of materials. I did this series because when I came to New York in 68, I met Rothko, and after some interesting discussion, he threw me out of the studio, but I learned a lot in that afternoon. He believed that he didn't he wasn't present when the paintings were made, his paintings. He was an existentialist, and so I pursued the idea of making paintings that were detached from my personal feelings and would exist on their own ground. But he was painting in a conventional manner, Rothko was, and I talked to him about that as a smart aleck kid would, and he threw me out of the studio. So I say I learned a lot. Well, the paintings I'm showing were painted from the backside. I didn't see the front. I have no idea what it was going to turn out like, and I certainly didn't know what it would turn out like after 30 years of existence and aging. There's were over 150 paintings in that series.
Where did they age?
Some outdoors, some in, how would you say, public environments, some in private environments, and many, some in storage. So they had a varied life.
Do they incorporate things like mold?
Yeah, we tended to, the clients tended to avoid that. There's a molding bacteria now that you don't have to use chemicals. It eats the mold and dies, which is pretty spectacular. So I learned a lot about that because they're linen and canvas and cotton duck. And
but that's why I was just going to ask what kind of material it was that would move from one side of the whatever it was to the other.
Yeah, it. I used virtually everything that's ever been used for painting, oil and pigments made from stone, synthetic pigments, everything. It took 5 years of study to gather a vocabulary to make these paintings. But my work is about energy and nature and using those things to make the art. I just start the art and then things happen to it. I was showing some drawings I did with Steve Jobs in 1984 to introduce the Macintosh at the Puck Building. He asked me to use the Mac to make art, and I spent a month playing with it, and I let the art take the lead, and then I interject as an artist things to the activity that's going on. And I mentioned on the internet film with MTV, because the interviewer was saying, well, what about all the choice of colors and the arrangements and where they go? And I said, that's the art part. And it went viral for a short while, the art part. That's what the artist does. But the drawings were million-line drawings. And in 84, I didn't know anything about computers, but I knew they don't get tired and they don't lie. So I exploited that in doing the drawings. And when they were shown at the Puck Building on the giant 50-foot display screen, the geeks of the day booed and showed that they were disgruntled, because their chant was, what did you do? The computer did it all. Your computer created these. What did the artist do? And I said, well, that's the future. It's a new paintbrush. They hadn't thought about it that way. They thought about using computers to replace conventional tools of art. And I see it as a whole new tool to be used. Those two reasons alone are enough. It doesn't get tired and it doesn't lie.
So you said you have somewhere around 200 pieces. Are they all hanging on the wall?
Some are on the wall, some are on the floor, and they're all over. When you work with nature, when you work with actuality, you can do anything. You can work with any material. Mm-hmm. And so it frees you up enormously. There's no constraints. I've got a friend who has an entire studio underwater in Bermuda, and he etches steel using the ocean, puts on scuba gear, and goes down and works in his studio. And if he gets it wrong and scratches the steel the wrong way or makes some mistakes in his mind, he's screwed. You can't do anything about it. You've etched the steel. You have to start over. And it's frees you to work with any material and make any kind of statement, but it also constrains you in that you better learn to collaborate with your materials. You better learn about your materials. An intern did this project last year, and she came up with over 300 materials I work with. I hadn't noticed, it's an exciting place to be. We've got 19 artists in the group who will be showing up here occasionally from all over the world, and half of them are not women, and they've come on to this idea of using energy and nature to do things. I'm doing a piece, another piece based on Rothko. He's pretty influential in a way. When you look at his paintings now, the big, broad color fields, the ones that are worth bazillions of dollars, he had to paint those at one go, and that'd be wet, or they would leave a brush mark, and he didn't want that. And he did. But they've aged now, about 50 years, and you can see his heartbeat as his hand went across the canvas, because it's oxidized a little, because it pulled away just a bit from the canvas. So I'm going to do a series of paintings exploiting the Parkinson's. I got 9/11 Parkinson's, and you won't see the mark of my hand until the painting ages and oxidizes, and it'll be evident that there was a tremor in creating the pieces, thanks to Rothko.
So your Parkinson's hasn't been a handicap. You're turning it into something worth incorporating.
I'm trying to put together. I got to perform with John Cage a while ago, and I think he'd like this a lot. I'm trying to put together a rock group, jazz group of musicians with Parkinson's, and we're going to exploit the tremor. We've already taken the name. We're called the Dyskinetics. And it'll be a lot of tambourines and maracas and stuff like that. But
the percussion is taken care of.
The thing is, they all know their stuff. They're older guys and women, and they know their music. And so
maracas would work, I think.
Tambourines. And I think we can raise a lot of money and have some fun to help the Parkinson's research. They've done some amazing things. I've got a new drug now that I just take one drug for the whole day, and it's amazing. If you behave and follow your doctor's orders on timing, it works really good. So
were you serious when you said your doctor ordered the caffeine?
Yeah, they found out that large amounts of caffeine stop the tremors. It's interesting.
Good to know.
Yeah. So I'm on high test. This just happened. The Met red carpet ball a few weeks ago. We were listed as the top 50 outfits on the Met carpet. And the photograph they took of me and my wife was 20 years ago. It's still being used as an example for unusual evening wear. She's wearing a Versace outfit there. She died in 2011 with 9/11 cancer. She would have appreciated that. I think the reason they did it, put us on that list, aside from the outfits and what, is we're the only couple in the group that isn't selling something. I mean, it's Madonna and Kardashian and Cher and everybody's selling something. We just were there because of the Met. Oh, a little sidebar about the Met. MIT Press is doing a biography about me right now, and I found out about this because of that. I've been in the Met for 3 years, two pieces in the Metropolitan Museum, and they didn't tell me. Like, who cares about the artist? The pieces were donated, and I could have used that on my resume.
So tell us more about your current show. Where do you go to see it, and when is it open?
It's going to run 6 weeks, mm-hmm. and we're there every day from 11 to 5, and it's in the middle of the building, pretty much. You go through the gauntlet of all the furniture.
What door number do you have to go through? I think that's the key for getting inside.
Well, if you can figure out where to park, door 15, it enters right into the space, to the gallery space. It's the my sponsor has negotiated a large space. It's like 5,000 square feet to show, and everybody is incredibly supportive there. Like I say, they're all independent cowboys, and but they help each other a lot, and it's a nice idea, and the whole place has grown organically. There was nobody designing it, or everybody had to figure out how to do this, how to change a warehouse into a event space and a retail space, and they've got every food group there of furniture and things, people just selling things, clothing.
So it's at the L&B Factory, what used to be called the L&B Factory, down behind Basilica, and it's every day open?
Yeah.
It's every day from 11 to 5.
Yeah.
And you can enter the building either from Front Street or for, I mean, if you're driving from 3rd Street,
yes,
South 3rd Street.
Right, or from Front Street. But I think to walk in, it's best to go from the Front Street side.
Front Street. And it's there's also door 21 on that side of the building.
What's that?
That's kind of a major entrance to the building from Front Street.
If you're coming from the city, you just, before you come into town, I call it the first building in Hudson.
It's a big white building.
Yeah, in a way, it is the first building in Hudson. And you just get right off at 9 there, and you're there, and you drive around the building.
9G, actually.
It's amazing what's happened down there. Some interesting things going on.
And things are changing constantly, which is, I think, vital to that kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. There seems to be an appetite for repurposing old furniture and things and redoing them. When I first came here, I downsized. I had 3 containers full of stuff, 600 works of art, and I decided to get rid of the furniture I didn't need. And I'm down to 4 storage units now. But I sold these chairs to a vendor, and they ended up in another shop, restored, and I can't afford to buy them now. That's a compliment better than money. It's strange. I've seen a lot of, sharing the merchandise with the vendors. They trade off pieces.
Sure. Well, different vendors have different clientele, and they know.
It's a big recycling project.
You know what they say, Ellen. It's, Hudson is just stuff passing from people to people in an endless circle.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
Every so often, a couple pieces fly off out into the greater world, but a lot of it does stay here.
Yep. I know that you have some in your house.
No, please, let's not go on about that again. My wife brings it in, I take it out. And it gets recycled.
He has seen it the second show.
Oh, that, yeah.
Are you familiar with the place called Inky Editions on the Front Street side?
George he's one of the early people there, and he's brilliant. I mean, he's brought something new, and he's dedicated to it. He's committed to teaching people the craft of printmaking and the art of printmaking. And he's got a spectacular facility. It's
he did all the interior work himself. It's a good space.
Physically himself.
Yeah, it's
amazing. And I hope I didn't upset him, but he overheard me explaining to somebody that it's a little piece of Chelsea here in Hudson. It's so nice. And we're starting some artists discussion groups there. And our first topic is, what makes you think you're an artist? And we're asking artists to tell about their first work of art, the thing that changed their mind, made them an artist, how they made this thing and said, my God, I'm an artist. And everybody seems to have a story. I found the first piece I made as a kid, and it's surprising because a couple of people responded and said, oh, that sounds boring, I don't want to do that. And then during the course of the dinner, they did an hour talking about their first work of art.
So did you say you found your first piece? You still have your first piece? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It was amazing. It just appeared when this became a topic. We had a gallery in Soho for 10 years, and every Friday we had public discussion with Artists Talk on Art. And the topics came from the street, and then we would talk about things like, what's it really worth? Why'd you buy it? Why'd you sell it? Why'd you make it? What's success to an artist? Topics like that.
We're talking to Terry Fugate Wilcox, who currently has a show down at the old L&B factory. Over roughly 200 pieces of art, and you can go down there anytime from 11 to 5 and see all this work, along with some other artists, and lots of furniture and antiques and maybe even stop by and do a little CrossFit in the meantime.
It's a whole little city in one building.
I hear the what are they? Digifab is going to expand down there too.
Uh huh.
Which is, you know, a nice little industry thing.
And the brewery just opened up a bar.
And now there's a brewery. So if you're like, after you work out, you can waste all that energy and go get fat on beer. Or you can go look at art when you're drunk.
There might be a little confusion because for years, certain people, I'm not sure why, called me Mr. Shakespeare. My wife's name was Valerie Monroe Shakespeare, and I took that as a name for a while because everybody was calling me that. And Chuck Close would call us Terry Valerie because he heard a child say that. So Terry Shakespeare has appeared now and again for other things. I think I'll use it as married name. For socially and use my maiden name for my art. I don't know how it's going to work out. But it's quite a name to have. And she was actually Bill's niece.
Bill who?
Shakespeare.
Uncle Bill. Uncle Bill. He wrote all those sonnets.
Is this the picture of your wife?
Yeah. Yeah, at the Met Ball 20 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got married the third day we met. I'm writing an autobiography about it. Well, I'm not really writing it. I can't write or type, but I'm doing a little girl's scrapbook journal with paste-ups and captions and things because there's no rules and you can't make any mistakes. And I am in the middle of, I don't think there's a pill for nostalgia, but between the biographer and me writing the autobiography, I got to do all this reminiscing. I guess that's how you write the book. We got married the third day we met, and we were together 50 years. I did nothing but make art, and I saw to it that Valerie could do whatever she wanted to do, as long as I could be there. And we were together 24/7. In fact, that's gotten a lot of traction because a friend asked Guinness to hunt down other couples that live together, that spend their lives sharing everything, work together and live together. And Guinness, after 2 months, and I consider them to be the prime research people on the planet, said they couldn't find anybody. They found older couples that had retired that lived together, and I'd like to meet couples that have decided to do that because we never thought about it. Our friends want me to explore the whys and ifs and ands about it. I was an artist and we could be together all the time, and we did. So I've written the first 15 years, and there's a special chapter called When Good Things Happen, Pay Attention, because all these things were happening to me in 1968, 69, 70, and I didn't notice. I heard you mention John Lennon's name earlier. Leo Castelli brought me to New York because Look Magazine did an article about us in Kalamazoo. Valerie said, we have to get out of town. She cold calls Leo Castelli, and he says, come here Saturday, I'll set you up. There's a new neighborhood coming up. And he could see Tribeca happening, so he got us a loft there. Within 2 weeks, I had a lot of parties and things because he introduced us to the Warhol crowd. I was the new kid. And I woke up at breakfast, and these people had fallen asleep during the party, and they're sitting across from the table, one of those old wooden cable wheels that everybody had for a table and a loft, those giant wheels. And it's Yoko Ono, John Lennon, Ray Johnson, Tom Waits, Nancy Holt, and Bob Smithson. And I'm going like, gee, New York's a friendly place. And I didn't realize this is important. Pay attention. Things are happening. And so I'm writing about that because I think it happens to everyone.
No, it never happened to me.
stop it.
But thanks for coming in. We've been talking once again to Terry Fugate Wilcox, who has a show currently running down at the old L&B factory, over 200 works every day from 11 to 5. Ellen, do you have any more questions?
I just want to say the gallery is called Art House, isn't it?
Yes.
Chris Selleck's gallery.
She created a building.
A building inside the building.
That sort of, that's where the artist, the flavor of the month is shown. And then we have this big open area where we can show other works of art. There's various artists have shown there in the last month. It's a good experiment, and I think it's working really well. I showed some paintings last month that were made with explosives, and they were hung crooked and haphazard because that's how they were made in the city. And the owner came in and he said, "You know, this place looks like a museum, but straighten up those paintings." it's engaging.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
I'm glad we finally connected. We tried to reach each other today, but it was good of you to come.
Well, I'm a big fan of your writings and revealings.
My writings and revealings?
Yeah.
I think he means your newsletter, Ellen.
The newsletter.
Oh.
I read it more as a diary of Hudson.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of that.
It's really important. And,
thank you.
A good thing. And it's gotten better and better.
Really?
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Well, there's more and more happening. So.
Well, thanks for coming in.